Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome again, everyone, to New Books in Women's History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jeanette Cockcroft, and I'm the host of this channel. Today, we're going to be talking with Jason Spraits and Kendra Bowen about the new book they've edited entitled Institutional Sexual Abuse in the Hashtag MeToo Era. Welcome, Jason and Kendra, to the show. I'm really excited to have you here.
Thanks for having us on, Jeanette. We're very excited to talk about the book with you and your listeners.
Absolutely. Why don't we start by each of you telling us a little bit about yourselves?
All right, Jason, you want to go?
Sure. My name is Jason Spraits. I am an associate professor of criminal justice at the University of Wisconsin, Eau Claire. Got my PhD from Indiana University of Pennsylvania in 2011. And I've been up here at UWEC for the past 11 years or so. And IUP is where I met Kendra. We were in the same doctoral cohort together. So that's just a little bit of a background. I can get into much more in a little bit, but I think Kendra can introduce herself as well.
Yeah. Thanks, Jason.
Yes. Hi. So my name is Kendra Bowen. I am an associate professor at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, also known as TCU. And like Jason said, we spent 4 years of our life at IUP, receiving our PhD in criminology, and that's where we got to know each other and started collaborating with research.
Excellent. Thanks so much. So why don't you give the listeners a little bit of background as to how you came to put this book together?
All right. Well, I can start, and it's kind of a circuitous route how we got here. I'll try to give an abridged version of it. But it has its roots in July 2013. The archdiocese that I kind of grew up in as a grade schooler and high schooler, the Archdiocese of Milwaukee, released or unsealed these documents about priests who had been accused of sexually abusing children. And because that's, you know, where I went to school, it was merely just a kind of curiosity to look at the files and see what was going on. And one of the files in particular, well, they all stand out in their own special way, but one really stood out in terms of research. And it was a priest who had been accused. I think he'd been charged. He actually had been charged. And he said about the charge, well, it's only a fourth degree misdemeanor. It's really not that big of a deal.
Yikes.
Yeah. And I thought, okay, well, there's techniques of neutralization right there. Let's file that away in case a research opportunity comes up at some point. And then a research opportunity came up. And since that time, Kendra and I have, well, we started looking at the clergy sexual abuse and techniques of neutralization, was kind of the first thing we looked at. We've looked at sexual grooming typologies and practices that priests within a number of dioceses have used. And then we've also looked at kind of the cover-up of the abuse. And that's really where the institutional aspect comes into play. And so we were, you know, publishing all these things, and not just on Milwaukee, but various dioceses throughout Minnesota, Illinois, so on and so forth. And Joe Schaefer, who is the series editor for the Perspectives on Crime and Justice series, which our book is a part of, he kept asking me, he's like, you should really submit a proposal for pre-sexual abuse or whatever. And I think we had talked, Kendra and I, and there wasn't, I don't think, enough there for a book to stand on its own, but we kind of had that idea in the back of our head as well. And it really wasn't until about 2017 where I did another chapter for an edited volume by Dan Lee and Carly Hilinski-Rosick on contemporary issues in victimology. And my chapter was on institutional sexual abuse, where I got to, within those 20 pages, explore a little bit more than just the priest and clergy sexual abuse. And I thought, okay, this is kind of where a book could go. And I talked about it with Kendra. And Kendra was on board. We submitted a proposal to SIU Press, and that's kind of how we got to where we are, where we were with putting the book together.
That's interesting. I think a lot of times, particularly in this political climate, people don't think academics do any research of any real world value. Not the case, huh?
Yeah, and that's what I love about this book. When Jason, when Jason asked me to collaborate with him, and I was so grateful that he did. One of the things I love about this book is that it kind of bridges that gap between academics and practitioners, in that it's a practitioner friendly book, and it's a very important topic, one that we are passionate about. And so I love that it gives kind of case studies in each chapter, that it gives case studies about things and gives real world implications of kind of, of policy implications on what can be done about this.
It's important. It's important work. So let's start with this question. What's the origin of the hashtag MeToo?
Yeah, so that's covered in the book, and we thought it was important to cover it because it had been co-opted a bit. And so, as you and your readers are likely to know, it was Tarana Burke who coined the Me Too movement when... But then it was 2017, I believe, when Alyssa Milano tweeted what she tweeted about sexual abuse, especially in Hollywood. And that kind of reinvigorated this idea of Me Too. But we thought and we knew that we had to give credit in the book, and everyone should just give credit regardless of where it started and its genesis. And so within the editing process, that was something that we had to like cut down from a number of chapters because a lot of our contributing authors also wanted to give credit where credit was due with the start of Me Too.
Absolutely. How is sexual abuse defined in this context, in this volume?
Related to the institutional setting?
Yes.
Yeah, I think the big thing between, and Jason, please speak up if I'm wrong, the big thing with just sexual abuse between institutional sexual abuse is when the abuser uses their power as a tool to harm somebody else in a larger setting. A lot of times it's person level crimes that people think about, especially with sexual abuse, like a a father with a, you know, a father with a daughter or a stepfather with a child. And part of what just sexual abuse in general and institutional is just that there's widespread cover up. People knew about it. I was just reading an article the other day out of Colorado, and a teacher had, had sexually abused over 30 boys. And when they asked the superintendent, and actually it's an article from last year, but it was about a case that happened decades ago. And when they asked the superintendent about why they did not notify police, you know, he pretty much said, why is it our responsibility to file a complaint? And I think that's one. Yeah. And so, you know, I think that's what sticks out to me as a difference with institutional sexual abuse versus sexual abuse, that you have people who know, they might not have been the perpetrator who committed the horrendous crimes, but they knew about it and covered it up or just chose not to do anything about it.
Yeah. So power is important. So these institutions, they're entrenched, they've built up power and they want to maintain that power. I think money is also a huge driver of this. Just to speak specifically on, you know, things that we found when examining the church, within these files, you'd have people who are very high up within a diocese say, we can't let this get out. We have a capital campaign ongoing where we're trying to raise funds. So that plays into it as well. In the book, we have a great chapter on sexual abuse in sports and that institution. And two of the main case studies there are, you know, two of the main cases that we've heard about within the last decade or so. And that's the abuse at Penn State University. And that was one of those things, you know, it's an elite athletic institution and an elite head coach who, you know, word is that the claims are that he knew about it. And then with USA Gymnastics, with Larry Nassar and what was going on there, again, a very powerful person and a powerful organization. So yeah, power has a lot to do with it. Prestige, maintaining a positive image of the institution.
Yeah, almost all of the authors to some degree are talking about the impact of hierarchy and money, as you've mentioned. What about the role of patriarchy and masculinity? That's something that was highlighted as well. So why don't you talk about that a little bit?
I can start here, and Kendra, you can jump in. I'm thinking about the chapters specifically on higher ed. And again, this is throughout the book, but I do know that our authors, three different authors, two different chapters on sexual abuse in higher ed, they talk about the patriarchy quite a bit and how young women on college campuses, this is beyond college campuses, are kind of told that people don't believe them and encouraged almost not to speak out. And again, that goes into power, kind of like you had mentioned. I don't know, Kendra, do you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think we all... I think we know. I'm teaching a crime victims class right now this summer. And so every morning we talk about, with all the topics we talk about, like a reoccurring theme is that kind of patriarchal hierarchy. And that it's just, you know, research continues to show when there is a hierarchy and there's a lot of males in an institution that gives an increased chance that a cover-up is going to take place. I think all the victimology research, you know, consistently shows with institutions, when you have that patriarchy, when you have male dominance, then there's likely to be, or a larger group of males at the top, that there's more likely to be a potential for a cover-up to take place. And we continually see that in the articles that have been coming out in the news recently with the sports situations that that Jason alluded to a while ago.
What's driving that on college campuses? Because my sense of it is that there are more young women now on campuses. So what's going on with this?
It would be pure speculation to really answer that question, but you're right. When you look at enrollment numbers at in universities across the country, it's 55-60+% women. But then I do think if you look at the percentages of people as professors, the percentages of people who are in administrative roles, I think that's where you have an imbalance back the other way with more men in charge. And
so when we're talking about sexual abuse on campus, what specific kinds of situations are we talking about? You've mentioned the issue with Larry Nassar at USA Gymnastics. What other context on campus do you see this being an issue?
Well, I think just in general reporting, I know that campuses have to report their crime stats through the CLEARI Act. But I also, and I, again, this is speculation on my part. It might be even me kind of, I don't even know. But the idea that, you know, there's fewer and fewer high school graduates, colleges are trying to position themselves to maintain enrollment figures. So, you know, maybe it doesn't look as good if you're showing a number of rapes and sexual assaults on campus. So maybe actively trying to deter folks from reporting these types of crimes, or even, I mean, we see it all the time where victims aren't believed, and how that can discourage someone from coming forward, where, you know, their credibility will be run through it. They'll be questioned. No one will believe them. And so that's obviously an issue everywhere.
And yeah, and I like, you know, we're talking about the campus climate and campus college cases. But what I like about the book is there's that reoccurring theme, no matter you're talking about college campuses, what you're talking about with religious institutions. We have a chapter on political institutions, you know, foster care system as an institution, custodial jails and prisons, and then in sports, and then in the media. And so you see these reoccurring themes that kind of what you're talking about in the college setting is very similar to the rest of these. And that's what I like about this book, is it pulls together. I think a lot of people, when they hear about this stuff, like originally they had heard about Boy Scouts of America, and then they had heard about the Catholic Church, and then, you know, and then of course the college campus, what's going on college campuses, and what, and so people kind of think about them in their silos. And what I like about this book and the chapters is it really brings together that it's institutions that you know, college campuses aren't unique to this. The religious institutions aren't unique to this, that it's happening in several organizations and has been for several decades. We've just been drawing light to it recently.
Right. On college campuses, what's the context in which this kind of abuse happens? Is this largely about campus social life or something else?
Yeah, I mean, I think the campus social life, when you're talking about, you know, Penn State's in this, people, you and I believe are in Texas. And so Baylor, you know, the Baylor scandal is, you know, one of the recent ones that happened in Texas with college athletes on college campus. But what ended up coming out was more than just athletes. It was other students who had been victimizing people. And those college student victims were going to deans and going through the appropriate channels to report. And people were there and we're like, oh, we can't help you. Or, yeah, we've heard this before, but we really can't do much about it. But yeah, so I think it's just the college life in general. And then there's stuff about sororities, fraternities, and the social activities involved, to go off what you were saying.
Absolutely. Jason, you look like you want to say something.
No.
Since you've already brought it up, let's talk about the issues of sex abuse within religious institutions, both Catholic and Protestant, because that's slightly different. That's not about social life, right?
Correct, yeah. What we've seen within the Catholic Church is it's not social, but social, I guess, mechanisms are used to perpetuate the abuse. And it's a power thing. Just as institutions are trying to maintain power, the individuals are trying to maintain power over their victims. So what we saw with priests in the Catholic Church was they were using their positions as priests to identify, who their targets would be. And was it a student who was serving as an altar boy? Was it someone who participated in some kind of youth organization with the church? Was it a young kid who maybe didn't have the most stable of home life? So what we saw there was priests kind of using their position that had been bestowed upon them as kind of this representative of the church, to not only groom the child, but also groom the family a bit and ingratiate themselves with the family and be able to go on trips to cabins, to movies, to get ice cream, all these different things, with the children who eventually became their victims. And I think to speak about religions that aren't the Catholic Church, similar mechanisms at play, with be it youth pastors with youth groups. I think that's how the Church Too movement started when some victims spoke out about the youth group leader, grooming them and then abusing them. I think there's an anecdote or a case study in our chapter in the book about a preacher who was kind of leading one of these evangelical churches and had used his position of power to coerce, groom, and abuse individuals. I think his secretary is the example that stands out more specifically. That's kind of how it differs a little bit in that regard.
Yeah, and building off of what Jason's saying too, what really fascinates me and the Catholic Church, I mean, it's happened in other churches. We're seeing it play out right now with the Southern Baptist Convention they're going through something similar right now. So building off of what Jason was saying, it really got me when we were doing all the research, just the blatant cover-ups. Like we talk about that priests use the techniques of neutralization to continue their offenses and stuff. But when we were looking through all the documentation too, with it, just the archdiocese and the different people who weren't even directly involved with that priest, but the higher-ups, trying to put a lid on it to cover up what was going on really got me, because I was just like, okay, this is not like your best friend over here. This is just another priest. And instead of you doing the right thing, and what I find fascinating about religious groups is, especially the Catholic Church, Jason and I grew up in a Catholic setting. And so, knowing that priests are supposed to kind of be that person in between the average citizen and God in the congregation, and then to have them covering it up you know, just because, you know, this person that they don't even, they might know of them, they might not be in the same congregation, but these high officials, you know, just being like, oh, let's just tell the families that we're dealing with it. No need to contact law enforcement. We're dealing with it. And meanwhile, we're just going to transfer that person to another diocese for them to do something horrible to another victim. And there was multiple transfers. Yeah, there's multiple transfers on average before they do anything to the priest. And then when they do stuff to the priest, it wasn't uncommon for them to send them off for treatment for, you know, alcohol or substance abuse problems or for mental health problems versus addressing the actual, you know, sexual abuse allegations.
Right. Is there a particular sort of victim? Are there certain characteristics that define someone most likely to become a victim of this kind of religious abuse?
What we saw with the Catholic Church was it was more likely to be young boys. The highest likelihood was, I think, between the ages of 11 and 14 for the young boys. That was within the Catholic Church data. And there's others like Karen Terry and her research team out of John Jay that did tons of research that actually laid the groundwork for what we were able to do. But to the best of my recollection, those are the numbers.
Yeah, and with Jason, one of the things that we like to talk about is and research is the grooming techniques used too, and obviously for that to be able to continue, you have to have grooming, short term, long term grooming to be able to continue that abuse, because obviously, you know, if somebody stands up, if you know, you start wrestling, tickling with somebody and they kind of stand up, a kid says, hey, this isn't right. Like, you know, my parents taught me this isn't right or whatever. Then that's going to decrease the likelihood that will continue in that regard. And so some of our other research has been on the sexual grooming aspect of, you know, the long-term effects of how do these people continually abuse kids and other kids.
Would you expand on that notion of grooming? That word is flying around a lot in contemporary politics, and I think it's important that we are all clear about what that is.
Yeah, so when we talk about grooming, we're talking about an abuser who is purposely engaging in conduct to lower the inhibitions and kind of put the antenna down of their potential victim. And there's a number of tactics that can be used. Kendra just mentioned one. She talked about kind of physical touch, how, you know, someone's going to tickle you a little bit, or they're going to maybe do something that might be deemed more normal, like a pat on the back, but a pat on the back and your hand lingers too long. And so that's kind of desensitization to kind of physical, but then it can also be emotional, building rapport, trying to, and we kind of call this like a false sense of rapport. Like you're building this fake relationship for the person, for the purposes of someone lowering their inhibitions and trusting you, and then you're taking advantage of that trust. There's also grooming, like I had mentioned earlier, of the community, of the family. With the priests, they would kind of get in well with the parents, you know, stop over for dinner, you know, be an ear to listen to if the parents have something going on, right? So that they're like, oh, this is a great person. You know, this is someone you can turn to. where then they would feel comfortable calling the parents up and saying, hey, you know, can I take your son to the YMCA or an overnight trip to this cabin? And the parents wouldn't give it a second thought. And the eventual victim wouldn't give it a second thought, right? They'd think, oh, you know, this is great. This is a priest. This is, you know, someone who I really look up to and adore, and they're giving me this attention. And then they're abusing that trust. So a number of different tactics. There's some good research that's just coming out on a group of researchers have developed a sexual grooming scale.
That's interesting.
Yeah, to kind of look at all of like how these different techniques are used. So, yeah.
Oh, that is interesting. Now, are these same techniques applicable in custodial situations, prisons, juvenile facilities? Are these same kind of techniques applicable, or because of the nature of that institution, is the approach somewhat different?
I'll start off, and Jason can finish off if he wants. But you know, I think when we were talking about the priest and stuff, I think the mentoring after school activities, coaches, people like that, you know, that's more applicable to. And then with minors, just any adult showing preferential treatment to build trust, or that unique kind of like making that person feel like there's a uniqueness in that relationship. When you're talking about custodial, I think it's a little bit different. And Jason, if you want to elaborate, too, when you're talking about custodial relationships in and of itself, and when you're talking about adults, it is simply illegal because those people in jails, prisons, in a custodial institution, they can't provide consent because they're not free to go from that institution. They're not free to make their own choices and decisions. So that is a little bit more unique. Jason, do you want to elaborate?
No, I think you kind of nailed it there when talking about the legality of it. And there's also just it's a power differential. I mean, I think there's a power differential in all these examples, but when you think about custodial institutions, jails, prisons, juvenile detention, there's definitely a huge power differential between the person who is the employee and the person who is being held there.
So the techniques don't really have to be quite so nuanced, is what I'm hearing.
I mean, they can still be used. There could be grooming used, but I think there's some differences as well, just with the power dynamics that are in play.
Absolutely. Let's talk about politics a little bit and political institutions in general in terms of abuse. What does that look like? And what sort of techniques do you see at work here?
I mean, just looking at the chapter in the book, it's power, right? There's people in power, and the examples in the book are predominantly men in power who are behaving poorly, who are breaking the laws by engaging in the conduct that, you know, we'll say allegedly that they're alleged to have partaken in. And there's very few repercussions. So I don't know, Kendra, do you have more?
Yeah, I think Amina does a great job. I think it's chapter 3 of our book in talking about that. And Jason, you know, did a great job explaining it. Mainly males, you know, tend to have historically dominated our politics and people in power. And it's very hard for victims to, you know, feel comfortable coming forward. And then when they do come forward, there's a lot of victim blaming and a lot of questioning that goes on instead of looking to that suspect and, you know, asking them about it. Victims can, you know, people automatically tend to go to that. Well, you know, you just wanted to see how far you could get with a person of power. Like it was good for you. It was good for you to be with somebody like that. Of course it was consensual and stuff. And so that's what also with the media and with the politics and stuff, what I find fascinating is, just the amount of people, instead of questioning the suspect, and people automatically go to questioning the victim's story.
Yeah. And I think, you know, the one thing that should be, apparent by now, but in many circles isn't, is that the alleged victims of these crimes, they really don't have a lot to gain, right? We see how they're treated, and how they are blamed for what has happened to them. And we look at it and it's like, well, who would want to go through that, right? Who would purposely stand up and say, you know, this Supreme Court justice or that Supreme Court justice or whomever did this to me, knowing the backlash that is going to ensue? I mean, I don't really want to talk too much about this because I wasn't following along that much, but we even saw recently with Amber Heard and Johnny Depp and just everything that came about because of that. And I mean, we don't treat victims well. So yeah, that's just the point I was trying to make.
Well, it brings to mind the phrase hegemonic masculinity. That appears in the chapter dealing with sports and sexual abuse. So can you talk a little bit about that notion of hegemonic masculinity?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so the media, you know, when you were bringing up, I think you're bringing up Dr. Wellman's chapter, and she brings up Harvey Weinstein as a case study and stuff. And so with that, it's just that whole idea of legitimizing a man's dominant position in society and justifying, you know, that power that they have over people. And so not just with that chapter, the other chapters too. I mean, that is a reoccurring theme. You see that in the sports world, because it tends to be, you know, a male alleged perpetrator and stuff. And so I do think that we are doing it. We have come a long way since the resurgence of the Me Too movement in 2017. I think people are paying more attention to this in society. I do think we have a long ways to go with it. But I think that's a reoccurring theme again with the institutions overall, that male dominance and what that brings when you have one gender in power over others.
So what can institutions do about rooting this out or preventing it, or at the very least reducing the incidence of it, right? At the end of the book, you have a pretty extensive discussion around this issue. So let's talk about that because I thought that was important.
Yeah. So, I mean, when we can trade off here, Kendra, if you want. But I think, you know, one of the most important things, and I'm going to go back to this, is believing the victim, right? And we know that it's very rare that someone makes up claims like this, very rare. So believing the victim and investigating the allegations that are made is really the least that can be done. I mean, that's not even a novel statement. You know, that's the least that can be done is good faith investigations about what is happening. So maybe then you can encourage other people in the future that if they are victimized to come forward as well, so they won't be victim blamed and they won't have to go through it like we're seeing victims go through it.
Yeah. in piggybacking off of that, Jason and I both have our PhD in criminology. We teach criminal justice and criminology classes, and that's what our research is in, besides with sexual abuse. And so one of the things that I try to get across to my students is a lot of people look towards the criminal justice system to, you know, to fix problems. And don't get me wrong, we can do, the criminal justice system can do a much better job, just like any institution can do a better job than what they're currently doing. But most violent crimes, and when you're talking about sex crimes, they're the most underreported violent crime. And so most of these crimes aren't even getting reported to police, for police and the criminal justice system to do anything about it. And so a lot of times I talk to my students just about what we're talking about. What can we do as a larger society, you know, to help reduce reduce these crimes? And piggybacking off of what Jason is talking about, the current research shows that, you know, about 3 to 8% of people actually don't tell the truth about sex crimes or make up that they were a victim of sex crime. So what that means is well over 90% of people are telling the truth. And we as a society tend to try to poke holes in the, you know, when anybody comes forward, they try to poke holes in it, or they say, like, what did you expect to happen, you know, with whatever this situation was, going back to what people were wearing and things like that. And it's I think it's more pertinent for the larger society to step back and be like, because I think it's just easier for us to victim blame or to question the victim, to think of, you know, step back and think more. I think it's harder for us to step back and think, okay, why do people think they have a right to do these things to other people? I think that's a lot harder for people. So they naturally go to the victim blaming. But teaching people as a society to not victim blame, to, you know, all of these institutions, or most of them, have implemented tons of training, including higher ed. There's a lot of training at TCU. We go through multiple trainings every year related to this, and we have to complete them and stuff. And so I think that's a good start, but we do still have a long way to go. And I think it's kind of up to society to just see how we can better treat victims, obviously, for the long-term effects of making sure they are resilient and come through this as best as possible, but also to encourage people to report. And that way it also will affect the criminal justice system and more people being likely to stand up. And so that's what I loved about the Me Too movement, is just giving victims a voice, and for people in society to realize, you know, we tend to stigmatize or victim blame, but most people, unless they live in a bubble, they know somebody who's been affected by sexual violence. And so in the big scheme of things, making people more aware of, hey, there's a lot of people who this has affected, including people you know and love. So let's try to figure out, you know, a societal way of combating this.
I think a lot of people have a hard time thinking they live within a context of institutions where people they know and people they love have been victimized. If it can happen to someone else, it can happen to you. And that's a very tough thing to have to think about. Jason?
Yeah. And so I did want to speak a little more and add on to what Kendra said, and kind of, you know, answer your question a little bit more as well, because we do have a number of other policy ideas. And one of the things Kendra had mentioned in her response was these trainings that institutions are making their employees do. And we talk about that in the book as well. These trainings, I think, need to be more user-friendly. They're very just kind of straightforward. They're not, you know, I don't know how exciting you can make them, but it's just something that people feel they have to do, and they're reminded, hey, you have to do this by this date. And so I think many people don't take them as seriously as they probably should, and don't really think about the things that they're learning within these trainings. But the trainings themselves are a good idea, right? Passing this information along to people is a good idea. We talk about mandatory reporting, which I mean, there's some arguments about mandatory reporting and is it a good idea, or does it, you know, does it stop the flow of information, right? If any of us are sitting there and we get this sense that our student in a meeting in our office is about to tell us something and we have to stop them and say, just so you know, I'm a mandatory reporter, then are they going to feel like they want to tell us? Do they want to take it further, or do they just want to like let somebody know? So I guess, you know, kind of looking at those laws and seeing how better to implement policy in that way. And then we do talk about institutional change and institutional transparency, which I think based on our conversation here, where we're talking about money and or not money, but power, but keeping things in place, that's even more difficult to do, to get institutions to change. Cause you know, we can sit around and talk about it and why it's a good idea and who it'll help. But we're not the ones in power. You know, we're not the ones that are most affected by this. So.
Well, that brings up an interesting question, right? One of the suggestions you offer is the diversification of the workforce, right? The more different sorts of people you have, the more likely it is that somebody somewhere is going to hear these voices. But what happens when these people are all part of the hierarchy and they become part of the power structure?
That was kind of why I said what I said was, and I guess I'll explain a little bit more, because people don't start off in power, right? They work their way up to power, and then it's, you can question, all right, well, now that they're in power, do they want to mess up or mess around with the status quo, or do they just want to keep things the same? So that's why I think it, you know, we make the suggestion, but I do think it'll be very difficult long term.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about the screening of potential employees. What would that look like? How could you screen out potential abusers, assuming that they don't all have police records and big scarlet A's? How would that work? What would that look like?
Yeah, I think a lot of the historical research showed is like minimal background checks were actually being done, if at all. And the whole idea is just being like doing a thorough background check. There have been some, this happens everywhere, but specifically in a city that where I, around wherever I live, there had been just recently some situations where some teachers got caught with child pornography on their work computers, and also with inappropriate relationships with minors. And what happened was the teachers just resigned, and nothing was really filed with the police department. And, because the school district was just thankful to get rid of the people. And so, closing loopholes like that, in that, hey, you need to report these things. Like, you know, you don't feel like it's your responsibility, but it is. You're in charge. You're an administrator of a school. You're in charge of an organization. It is your responsibility to report. But when you don't do things like that, then that allows, you know, people to go on to other institutions, to other organizations, and continue that. And so I think with just educating more people with trainings and the bystander education, you see something, say something type things, and just making it a lot harder, like closing those loopholes, will, I think, go a long way in helping that.
That makes sense, right? Otherwise, there isn't any trail for a background check to find. I think I've probably taken enough of your time. So I want to thank you both very much for a really interesting discussion about a very important topic. Before I let you go, why don't you, each of you, tell us what's coming up for you? What are you working on next?
Oh, okay. So I'll go. So right now, currently, I'm working on a lot of my research focuses on sex crime in general. And so I am myself and a couple of colleagues from TCU in my department have teamed up with the district attorney's office and a local district attorney, and we have been looking at the sexual assault cases, and we have teamed up with them too. And what I love about this is that this district attorney came to us and was like, I think we can be doing more for victims of sexual violence. Can you look at this and help us? And besides wanting to look at other aspects of it. And so because of our latest research, they created a specialized unit for the prosecution of sexual assaults, which is pretty cool. And so we're now looking at that. We're looking at kind of pre that specialty unit and post since the changes before and after, because we have that data, and we're looking at some other crimes at that DA's office. I'm also doing some research with the Children's Advocacy Centers of Texas, looking at law enforcement resources and collaborations when working child abuse cases here in the state of Texas. So I have that and some stuff going with the local police department about violent crime reduction strategies, because a particular what we're seeing across with COVID that some of your big cities are experiencing spikes in violent crime. And so some colleagues and I are working with a large police department around here on trying to come up with some policies and some improvements to decrease violence in our area.
Oh, that sounds exciting.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And yeah, that sounds great. Wow. So for me, this summer, I just teamed up with two of our students, and this was their idea. We are surveying local law enforcement officers from about a half dozen different agencies within our region about, you know, stress, mental health, and well-being. And so we just launched that survey within the last week. And then we're asking, you know, if they want to participate in follow-up interviews. We're scheduling those. And this is, you know, completely student-led. I'm kind of the mentor overseeing it, but it's a new area for me. But then even thinking about more of this, the sexual abuse based research, one of the reasons I knew a lot about that sexual grooming scale is I think I was a blind reviewer on a number of the manuscripts. And so that piqued my interest as well. As I'm reviewing these manuscripts, I'm like, okay, so they've developed this sexual grooming scale. How can I apply that to these files that we have from priests from dioceses throughout the country? So that's something that I need to really sit down and get a grasp on how to design that research, because that's where I think the next iteration of that research will go.
Yeah, that is also very exciting. Anything that has students, undergraduate students?
Yeah. So UW-Eau Claire is really well known for its undergraduate research program.
That's fabulous. Those are fabulous opportunities. Well, as I say, I've taken enough of your time. So thank you both very much. I've enjoyed it, and very informative and very timely. So thank you both.
Thank you for the opportunity. We appreciate it.
Of course.
Yes, thank you. And thank you to your listeners as well.
Absolutely. I think the listeners are going to find this to be very informative. So thank you.